Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Continuing with the chapter on the fourth exit point from the cycle, related to the fourth noble truth, that of the way leading to the ending of suffering. And the next section is called Mindfulness of the Body and the Self-Adjusting Universe. The most reliable means of sustaining mindfulness in our daily lives is to use the feelings of the body. Mindfulness of the body is our guaranteed anchor for the present reality. No matter how much our mind has to think about, past or future, plans or problems, abstractions about the present, the body is always here. The body is like our most reliable friend. It's always here to come back to. No matter how far away the mind goes, the body is always here. That is 100% reliable. So, to sustain the quality of mindfulness and awareness in daily activity, traveling, being with people, working, living, interacting with family, and so on, if we develop an ongoing mindfulness of the body, that is a guaranteed way to key the attention into the present moment experience. And so that there's many, many teachings that the Buddha gives about mindfulness of the body, various different places in the Pali Canon. And it's in the very beginning of the four foundations of mindfulness is kayanupassana, mindfulness of the body, and the many, many different dimensions. That it's actually the largest section of the four foundations of mindfulness is on mindfulness of the body and various different aspects of that, the movements of the body, sitting, standing, walking, lying down, how the body is composed of the four elements or different. Bones and blood and flesh and so on and so forth, and the different death contemplations, funeral ground contemplations, and many, many various different ways of reflecting upon the body. And so there's different dimensions to that. But I think in terms of our day-to-day practice, then simply that noticing and recollecting the sensations of the body and using that like a direct appreciation of in this moment the body feels like this, there's this sensation, or you're just naming the posture that you're in, that I'm sitting or I'm standing, I'm walking, this is the feeling of sitting, it feels like this is the feeling of walking or standing, it feels like this. And that very simple direct way of keying the attention into the body is a guaranteed way of bringing the attention to the present. And that so often particularly life outside the monastery, but even life within the monastery, the attention can be caught up in the remembered past, the imagined future, getting lost in various abstractions. And as I said here, it's like the body is like the most faithful friend. No matter how far you wander off, the body's always here to come back to. And and so that that sense of paying attention to the present is the root of liberation and the way to the ending of suffering. Because if the mind is not paying attention to the present, then it can't be in tune with reality, because reality happens in the present. And so if the mind is creating an image of the past and going off and inhabiting that, or creating some abstraction in the present, or a plan or imagination for the future, it's the attention is intrinsically caught up with the unreal, or the superficial, or the created. John Lennon misquoted Dr. Johnson by saying life is something that happens while we're making other plans, so that we easily are making plans and getting caught up. So I forget Samuel Johnson's exact words, but in one of John Lennon's songs, he says, life is what happens while we're making other plans. So we miss our life because we're so busy thinking about our life, how it was, or how it's going to be in the future. So this present reality is where life happens. And this is the place where a difference can be made. So the more that the attention is paid to the present, then the more that skillful and valuable differences can be brought into being with respect to our lives. If we're not paying attention to the present, then necessarily the mind is out of tune with reality. That makes sense? Hopefully. It should be that when you hear it, well, of course. Yeah. There should be, ideally there isn't, of course. But it's remarkable how easily the mind is drawn into worrying about the future, recollecting the past. I did a huge amount in my early years of monastic life of rewriting the past and then worrying about it. Yeah. Finally, I would go back and rejig some situation and then worry about a completely invented set of circumstances that hadn't happened, that then I could get drawn in, an embarrassing number of times. I think, well, it didn't happen that way. So, and it's already, and what did happen is already in the past. So it's not a problem now. Oh yes, yes. Rather like young Ajahn Lee in the Kuti with the rain on the roof. It's like, yeah, it didn't happen that way, and it's not a problem. So just let go. But it was amazing the amount of imagination that the mind could create, and rewriting the past and getting caught up with it. And also scripting the future, which I found that I was, along with rewriting the past, I was writing the future, and often I'd find myself preparing conversations, or when this happens, I'm going to say this, or when that happens, I'll do that, that was again a very strong compulsive mental habit, I found that after about 5 or 6 years of writing scripts that nobody else ever followed. Speaking of scripts people live, I kept writing these scripts and like, yeah, he doesn't know his lines, you know. When we were going to meet, he was supposed to say that. I've got my piece prepared, but he's gone off in that direction or over there instead. So, so something in me just gave up after about 5 or 6 years. It just sort of, with a completely sort of zero reinforcement, like a 0% success rate. It's like, this is pointless. But not having seen how that worked for the previous 20 years of my life, that process had got a lot of momentum behind it. But actually looking at it, watching it and seeing, no matter how much you predict the future or you plan how things are going to be or what you're going to say, it doesn't turn out like that. So with zero success rate, something just gave up, so that was a lot more peaceful. Any questions, thoughts? Okay. The body is also a gauge for our emotional state. This is another benefit of mindfulness of the body. If you bring attention to the body and you realize that you're racing along at speed, this can help us to reflect, where am I running to? Where's the fire? Slow down. Or maybe we notice that our belly is tightened into a knot. That tells us that we're feeling worried or anxious. Okay, breathe out, lighten up. Each of us will find that emotions appear in different ways in our bodies, in different forms. The act of attention is the balancing agent. It's not as though there needs to be an inner commander-in-chief, a managing director that says, you're going too fast, slow down, or your belly is tight, you need to relax. Rather, there is the simple act of attention that brings the quality of awareness to the lack of balance. This imbalance is noticed, and the awareness has its own effect. It's a self-adjusting universe. Let's say, for example, you're sitting at your computer desk and you realize that you're tight and hunched over. Try saying to yourself, I'm all slumped over. I'm not going to do anything, but I'll just let the quality of awareness have its effect on my posture. See what happens. We discover, usually, hopefully, I don't have to do anything. The universe adjusts itself as the natural effect of attuned awareness. So this is something you can experiment with at home or in your room, your kuti or wherever. And so it's And maybe people have noticed this already, but when you, rather than if you find yourself sort of tense and uptight as you're kind of typing away, or you've hunched over your keyboard or over your pot of porridge that you're stirring, you're kind of you're tense and uptight, rather than, oh, I'm really tense, I should relax, like the sort of command from the superego or the manager that says, you need to relax. Okay, relax, relax, relax. Like a thing that I have to do. If you bring attention to that tense state, then without trying to do anything, just the appreciation, the acknowledgement of that tense quality, then there's a recognition of this is hard work, this is uncomfortable. And then without having to do anything, then the system relaxes on its own. That's what I mean by a self-adjusting universe. Isn't that, again, that's not a classical Buddhist term, it's just a way that I like to describe that. And it's an extremely helpful principle, and it goes back to what I was saying about effort. When effort is made based on right view and free of I and me and mine, then that effort will have a peaceful balancing effect. It'll bring about a sense of integration, peacefulness. If effort is made based on I should be doing this, I want to get that, I don't want to be this way, I'd like to be like that, all that I making and mind making, even if it's sincere effort with a wholesome intention in mind, there's always that there's more of me in it. So there's that it brings about a slight or very distinct quality of imbalance or tension. And so this is something that I encourage people to experiment with. So like if you, in meditation, if you find that you've drifted off and you're all sleepy, then, oh my goodness, my nose is pointed at the floor. that's not the Buddha Rupa, that's the carpet. Rather, I should sit up straight, sit up, to just notice that slumped quality, and then I'll just give a little demonstration now. So I'm not going to do anything. This is a kind of a show and tell. So I won't do anything. Just bring your attention to this slumped feeling. I didn't do anything. That's just the mind aware of the system out of balance, and then it adjusts itself. I'm not showing off. I mean, you can do this too. We all work. We're all built the same way. Try this at home. But it's not just our posture when we're sitting. It's also that applies to all sorts of dimensions of our life and our work, our relationships, and that whenever the mind says I should, or I want to, or I ought to, or I don't want to, I shouldn't, then that's a clear sign. That's a flag for the I making and mind making coming into the picture. And instead, to just bring it that quality of awareness to that sense of things being out of balance or out of whack, and then just letting the system adjust itself. Another way of thinking of it is like as if the Buddha walks into the room, so everybody either becomes peaceful or more alert, or both. That's inviting awareness into the picture. That's the brightening and balancing and calming agent. That's the element that brings things into balance. And so when we talk about taking refuge in the Buddha, it's also that inviting that quality to be present and then letting that have its effect. Any thoughts, questions? I do encourage people to experiment with that. Extremely useful principle to get a feeling for. And then the mind sees how it works, and the more you trust it, the more that it becomes just a basic mode of relating to life and the world. So the next section is called Compassionate Action and the Attitudes of a Well-Rounded Person. We do what is possible to bring our practice to our working life, our family, our relationships. As we engage with other people, we might notice that if we pay attention to ourselves, we automatically adjust to the group, and the group adjusts to us. Human life is a relational experience. Even when we're not talking, we respect each other's presence. We care about each other. We make space for each other. We're existing in a relational state. And it's not just talking about being in monasteries. it's saying that driving on the road, you know, that people, this is, I mean, people are obeying the traffic laws, but just they're also naturally making space for each other and respecting each other on the, you know, getting onto a tube train or going to a family supper. You know, unless you're a complete sociopath, you know, and you're totally absorbed in your own version of reality and utterly insensitive to everyone, everything around you, which is extremely rare. Most 99.99% of people, we are aware of each other's presence, and we are adapting to each other and respecting the fact that we are in a relational state with each other. We affect each other. We carry into our lives that spirit of natural care and attention and harmonization with others. This is what I would call living in, according to the middle way. It means the development of the Eightfold Path in order to cultivate life as a well-rounded person, a sapurisa. We too can be that very kind of good person, quote-unquote, that it's useful to associate with, which is a compassionate offering to others as well as being beneficial for ourselves. So there's a point that I like to emphasize when it says sapurisa sangseva, associating with good people. You can be one of the sapurisa that other people are benefited by associating with, if you can follow that. So rather than just thinking, it's helpful for me to be around good people, it's also if you manifest these qualities of a sapurisa, a well-rounded, good-hearted person, then you are thereby a blessing in the lives of others. Of course, if the ego grabs hold of that and says, you know, you're so lucky to have me around. I'm a sapurisa. You know, I'm one of the wise that you're fortunate to associate with, and I'm one of those fools. And that's a drifting towards psychopathy and narcissistic inflation. So that's not helpful. But I think that's probably very, very rare. People tend to incline more towards self-criticism and self-denigration, but I do feel it's not just what we get from others that is important, but also what we're offering to others, and there's many different dimensions to that. According to the Buddha's teaching, in the Numerical Discourses, Book of the Sevens, Sutta number 68, again, you can look that up if you're interested. A well-rounded person, one who can be counted on as a truly valuable member of society and who is able to encourage the community and society towards greater peace and well-being, possesses seven specific qualities. Hence, it's in the Book of the Sevens. So I thought in this chapter I highlight these. And I was introduced to these in a very helpful little book by Venerable Paiuto, P.A. Paiuto, called A Constitution for Living. And he's one of the most admired and accomplished Dhamma teachers in Thailand, and very, very highly regarded. This is the great Buddhist scholar and also exemplar. He has his tome is called Buddha Dhamma. It's like a kind of encyclopedia of Buddhist knowledge, and it's extremely well researched and well explained. And even though he's very famous, he's very highly regarded, very respected, he's one of the seven most senior monks in Thailand. I think he's a Somdet, which is, there's only seven, some maybe nine. Anyway, he's one of the 10 most senior monks in Thailand. But for years and years, he just used a copy of the book, Buddha Dhamma, was his pillow. So that was he lived and lives in a very, very modest way. He doesn't have a luxurious life at all, and he's very much walks the talk. So in that book, Constitution for Living, and this is one of the chapters, he outlines the seven qualities of a Sapurisa, and I was always impressed by that that set of qualities and his explanation, his commentary on that. So again, if you want to look up that book, I'm pretty sure we've got quite a few copies in the library, A Constitution for Living, and it's got very helpful descriptions of the qualities of a good householder, the qualities of a good leader, the qualities of someone who's a helpful member of society, the qualities of someone who's committed to Dhamma practice and so on. And he takes these essential teachings from the suttas and then expounds on them. So it's a very valuable little resource. It's not a tome. It's only about 80, maybe 60 or 80 pages, maybe 100 pages, but it's not a massive volume, but a very handy little compendium of essential teachings. So of these seven qualities, the first one is Dhammanyuta. So that each of them ends in the word, the syllables anyuta. So anya is knowledge, and the ta at the end means the quality of or ness. So Dhammanyuta is the knowledge of Dhamma-ness. That's a pretty clumsy term. So Dhammanyuta. And in this respect, it doesn't just mean sort of general Dhamma teachings, but it's referring to the causes or the origins of things, where things come from, what they're based upon. That's what this quality of Dhammanyuta, so knowing the origins of things, or contemplating the origins of things-ness. So Dhammanyuta, this means knowing principles, knowing the origins and causes of things and where they come from. If we know the underlying principles governing things with which we must deal, then we'll be much more in tune with situations as we carry out our daily tasks. At the highest level, Dhammanyuta means fully knowing, appreciating, and harmonizing with the laws of nature, so that one can deal with life and the world with a mind that is free, not resentful of or confined by those laws of nature. And so laws of nature being all things that are born and going to die one day, or the laws of gravity, the fact that you need to breathe, that you get hungry, you need to live in relationship with other human beings, other living the living world. And so it's what I would refer to as a nature-centered perspective, or Dhamma-centered perspective, rather than a self-centered perspective. So Dhammanyuta is that reflecting or contemplating the causes or the origins of things, where things come from. And then its partner is the next one, which is Attanyuta, A-T-T-H, Anyuta, Attanyuta. This means knowing objectives, knowing what direction things are heading, having an appreciation of likely results. If we know the reasons behind the task we're doing and the objectives it has, we're likely to be able to steer things in a direction that will be beneficial for all. To develop Attanyuta means to know what may be expected in the future from the actions that we're doing in the present. At the highest level, Attanyuta means understanding the implications of the way nature works, coupled with an intrinsic intention to guide our actions and speech to be of the highest benefit, supporting the well-being of all to the best of our ability. So it's to do with setting a direction, again, through watching how nature works, how the laws of cause and effect operate. So, this is the effect that looks like it'll be most helpful. Let's make choices and head in that direction. So it's an appreciation of wholesome results. So it's a kind of reasonable hope, as it were, a direction for what looks like will be a beneficial result. Of course, everything's uncertain, so we never know exactly how things are going to turn out. But so there is that sense of a setting a direction, heading in things in towards objectives that are apparently beneficial, But with that, there's also the reflective element of, okay, well, let's see whether that does actually arrive at something beneficial. Or yes, the result that I wanted came, but there was all these complications that came with it. Aha! So along with achieving objectives, then there's that also that reflective element. And all of these seven, in a way, they're a kind of detailed expansion of the quality of mindfulness and full awareness, sati sampajanya. And so along with that, steering things in a helpful, or what seems to be a helpful way, there's that, okay, well, did we get the result that we were expecting? Yes, okay, now what's come with it? And aha, there are all these riders that were there in, that I wasn't aware of, I didn't think of that. So, aha, well, I got what I wanted, but I got this and this and this as well. Right, okay. And then we learn from the way that things turn out, so then that becomes a source for greater understanding, so that you recognize the whole field of cause and effect, and then you're learning as well as one can from all of that. The other thing to say about atanyuta, this one, say the setting a direction, it's also, there's partly in terms of sila, or in terms of conduct, it's slightly related to otapa, like in hiri otapa, that which otapa is sometimes translated as a wise fear of consequences. So that if you think, well, this is a good direction, but is it totally legal? Or is this going to be harmful? Or is, I'm taking a risk here. This might be, I might break something, or I might fall off the edge, or this might not be something that everyone likes. So that otapa is a wise fear of consequences. So again, it's maybe fear is not a perfect word, maybe a sense of caution or a appreciation of risk. It's a sort of the Pali word for risk assessment. Okay. what's likely to come out of this? How's this going to work? What's the level of risk? And so then also highlighting whether something is got a possibility of not being in accordance with sila, or just being something that is sort of dangerous or likely to possibly cause harm. You know, how far out along this branch can I go before the branch starts cracking? that kind of thing. So along with hope and a sense of a good direction, is also that sense of caution. Like, well, let's be careful here because we're not sure how this might end up, and that could cause myself harm or others harm. And you know, I might be okay with falling out of this tree, but then there'll be others who have to pick me up and get me to A&E and get patched up. So let's bear that in mind. So any questions on those first two? You won't be tested at the end. So Dhammanyutta is the first one, and Attanyutta, A-T-T-H, is the second one. The third one is Attanyutta with no H, A-T-T, so Atta as in self. So the word Atta is not completely forbidden in... not a forbidden concept, but it's an informal, and it's used in a relative sense, like talking about this being. So atanyuta, the knowing your selfness is atanyuta, knowing your selfness. This word is spelled similarly to the previous quality, but it has a very different meaning. This is essentially the necessity of knowing yourself. We need to appreciate the characteristics of our own conditioning, our personality, our age, language, nationality, education, and so forth. Are we an artistic type or scientific? Are we an extrovert or an introvert? Female or male? What's our family background? Rich or poor? What are we good at? What are we not good at? Primarily, we need to learn that we can't do everything. And when I was looking through this today, I realized that assumes that people want to be able to do everything. I mean, that's a bit of a character trait that I would just assume that everybody would want to be able to do everything. I thought, well, actually, it's probably not the case for everyone. So I noticed that the Amara Atta, my particular character trait of I want to be able to do everything, that came into the picture there. So we can't do everything, assuming that we want to, and that it will help tremendously to be acquainted with the various strengths and weaknesses and cultural biases that pertain for the attitudes of this being. If we can fully acknowledge the array of conditioning variables of our makeup, we can then act accordingly. We do what is needed to be done to act skillfully, meanwhile making effort to learn skills or abandon bad habits so as to evolve to greater maturity. So this is, again, it might seem like it's going counter to the principle of anatta, not self, but on a level of conditioning and the conventional truth, then we have names, we have ages, birthdays, life stories, the different families we've come from, different passport numbers, and so on and so forth. So there is, on the level of convention, and then there are these different beings with their different sets of conditioning. So it's about getting to know the different factors, the different things that play into that. And it's, one of the things I've often mentioned is that even though my family is not entirely English, my mother's father was German, and half German, half Belgian, and my grandmother, my mother's mother was Belgian, so I'm not completely English, but by conditioning, having grown up in this country and gone to English schools and such like, then I had assumed that my reality, my kind of Englishness, was ordinary, was normal, and that when I went to live at Wat Nanachat and was living amongst a large variety of nationalities, I suddenly began to realize that being English is not normal. It's not the baseline. It's just one variety, and that sense of what I've thought of as being normal and real, it's just one possible set of conditioning amongst all these Australians or Americans or French people or Thai people, Lao people, and so that was quite an eye opener. How I thought I was normal, and that it was really the first time I appreciated the sense of very very consciously. This is the way I see things, and my mindset. It's just one particular pattern that's formed. It's not a baseline. It's just one kind of tree in the forest, one shape of things. Another example also that was really striking to me, before that, when I was a college student, I was sharing a flat with another. I studied psychology and physiology at London University, and I was sharing a flat with myself and another of the people in my year in psychology. And we were sharing this place together, and I made some comment quoting Winnie the Pooh and Christopher Robin, something like that, the A.A. Milne stories, which I grew up with, and the books of poems like When We Were Very Young or Now We Are Six, and these stories of Christopher Robin and Winnie the Pooh, and I thought that was normal. And so anyhow, I made some comment in a conversation with this friend of mine, Patrick Field is his name, and he immediately kind of snapped at me and said, "You bloody middle class rubbish." I'd never come across anybody who disliked Winnie the Pooh or Christopher Robin. That was sort of in the world that I grew up in, which I thought was normal. Then of course Winnie the Pooh and Christopher Robin are symbols of pure goodness in the universe. Patrick joined the Communist Party when he was 16. And actually he's from hell. His dad, I think, was also a Communist Party member. So as soon as he was old enough, he joined the Communist Party. And he's a very interesting fellow. He was a playwright and an actor as well. He's part of the National Youth Theatre when he was younger. And he was also a very keen cyclist. So he... The last time I saw him, he had this campaign of promoting the bicycle as a political weapon, getting people to ride bicycles and stop driving cars around. And he came and visited me here once at Amaravati on his bicycle. I think he was riding up to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival up in Scotland. So, very interesting character. But that was quite, because we were good friends, and it just had never occurred to me that anyone could find any fault with Winnie the Pooh and Christopher Robin. And so it's utterly normal. Like, say, one of the poems or the songs in, I think, Now We Are Six is, they're changing the guard at Buckingham Palace. Christopher Robin went down with Alice. Alice is marrying one of the guard. A soldier's life is terrible hard, says Alice. And the fact that you have a nanny, like Patrick pointed out, not everyone grows up with a nanny. But, well, I didn't. Well, actually, I did a little bit. For a while. And and so it's like, oh, and then he sort of gave me a quick snapshot of the other aspects of life. The majority of people who live in this country do not have nannies, and the life of the working class is very, very different. And I was probably having my jaw hanging open, like, wow, I never thought of that. Never occurred to me. But that was up to that point, that was an assumption, that this is a pure and good thing, and of course everyone sees it in the same way. And that Christopher Robin is not a sign of goodness, it's a sign of the oppressive class of the haves. So, also with respect to our getting to know our personality and our and some conditioning, it can easily be that we there's aspects of our own character or how we are that we might resent, that we're too talkative or we're too shy, or we're, if only I had a different personality, if only I wasn't like this, if only I could just be someone else, then it would be great. And often we can focus on things and then build a lot of self-view around our shortcomings. If only I was different, then everything would be fine. And I've certainly felt that myself. But what this is about, or this atanyuta, is in a way making friends with what your conditioning is. Not trying to make yourself into some sort of an ideal, but using the characteristics you have, your language, your education, whether you're shy or whether you're outspoken or whether you're an artistic type or a scientific type, or whether you're a completely incompetent type. But that's what you function through, rather than thinking, I've got to be something different in order to succeed or be good or get things right. But rather, you use the way you are, your character, as the medium through which you operate. That's what one of the things that I think both Lumpo Cha and Lumpo Sumedho are very, very skilled at in terms of their guidance of communities, was that for both of those ajahns, they never set things up with that sense of, you know, you've got to be like me in order to be practicing well, or that, you know, my character or my way of doing things is the model. But for both Lumpo Cha, Lumpo Sumedho, they're incredibly accommodating and ready to let people be who they are. And so that they're not trying to force people into a particular mold or a sort of preformed ideal, but to use the characteristics that you have, your background, your conditioning, your personality, that's the medium through which you operate. And so you learn to be more comfortable with your character, your quirks, your blessings and your curses, and so that you're learning to work with the way things are, rather than the kind of extremes of attaching identifying with the way things are, or suppressing it, hating it, fearing it, and resenting the way things are. You're learning to work with that. That becomes the vehicle for how you function, and so then it's just in a way living far more from a nature-centered perspective than a self-centered perspective or an idealistic perspective. That makes sense? Any questions, thoughts? Yes.
I was going to say, groups that I used to work in a school, and it made me think a lot of, you know, when I was at school as well, that that's not really encouraged. Well, I didn't feel that, you know, I felt like I had to kind of strive towards being, you know, a certain way or learning a certain way.
To be the teacher.
Or to actually as a child as well.
Uh-huh.
That's what I remember,
uh-huh.
You know, trying to fit a certain way. Or, and also when I worked in school as well, that there didn't feel like there was much leeway for, you know, being, having differences and uh-huh. different ways of, this is, you know, maybe not all schools are like that, but I felt a few that I've worked at have been, you know, not so encouraging in that area. So I feel like coming here, you know, has been the first time for me to feel like, oh, that's okay for you, you know, to be kind of, and that feels, it's like a new feeling for me. I can imagine that, you know, maybe a lot of my friends maybe as well would notice that, but that complete feeling of being allowed to grow in the way that, you know, with the capabilities that you've got.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which, just been very aware of coming here.
Oh, good.
Yeah. But it takes me aback a little bit sometimes. I'm like, oh, really? Are we, you know, can you really do that? Because it's really kind of accepted.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. Yeah. Any Gareth, Alex, you were going to say something? Or?
No, just emotion. Just like, nothing.
Yeah, it's quite a relief. I think for many of us, you grow up feeling you've got to be this thing that they expect, the mysterious they who sit in judgment over your life. What will they think? I mean, it's hard to actually pin down who they are, but a lot of our lives are run trying to fit with what they expect, what they think and what they want. So it's not a matter of not caring or being casual, but just being in a way so comfortable in your own skin. One of the really interesting suttas is, again, I haven't got it here this evening, it's called the Mahāgosīṅga Sutta, and it gives you a kind of snapshot of the characters of the different great enlightened monks. And it starts off in this beautiful moonlit night in the forest, the Gosinga Sala wood. And I think it's Venerable Ananda, I think it starts off with him and he's saying, wow, this, what a beautiful night. The moon is lighting up the forest, all the sala trees are in flower, there's beautiful fragrances from the blossoming trees wafting through the forest. You know, what kind of a monk would light up the forest on a beautiful night like this? Sort of this thought pops into his mind. So he goes around to see his good friend Venerable Sariputta, and I think that's the way around it works. Anyhow, so he goes to see Venerable Sariputta, and so then he asks that question. You know, the sala tree forest is lit up by the moonlight, and its beautiful fragrances, it's like heavenly scents in the air. What kind of a monk would illuminate the forest on a night like this? And then Sariputta says, oh, one who is able to enter any state of meditation at will, and who has completely mastered the mind in terms of meditational skill, and one who can, you know, explain the Dhamma in all its facets. That's the kind of a monk that would light up the forest on a night like this. And then they go to see Mahamoggallana, you know, and they say, what kind of a monk do you think would illuminate the forest on a night like this? Well, one who's accomplished in psychic powers, who can visit all kind of different, all different realms of being, and who is able to see into the all the different dimensions of the great 3,000-fold universal system. And then in each one they go to see Mahakasapa, and they say, "What do you think?" Well, the one who's most diligent in all the ascetic practices. And each one, it's the kind of their own special feature. Like they, these are all arahants, so they're not kind of boasting or being proud, but the mind immediately goes to the thing that the kind of their shtick, you know. And then when they ask Ananda, they say, "Oh, one who's completely memorized all the teachings and can recount all the, you know, all the words of the master, you know." And so they go one after another to the different great enlightened elders. And then they go and see, they say, "Well, let's go and ask the master." You know, that's they finally think, "Well, let's go and ask the Buddha." And it's one of the few places where you get the Buddha speaking about his own character. Almost unique in the whole Pali canon. And they're kind of, you know, it's like sort of the lads are having fun for the evening, as it were. So that, you know, these enlightened lads go around to the Buddha and say, "Your venerable sir, you know, the solitary forest is filled with moonlight, and it's, the fragrances from the blossoms are in the air like it's a heavenly realm. What kind of a monk do you think would illuminate the forest on a night like this?" And he says, "The kind of monk that would sit down and make the resolution, 'I will not move from this spot. You know, my blood can dry up, my bones can turn to dust, but I will not move from this spot until full and complete enlightenment is realized.'" So that he pointed to resolution adhidhana being his own shtick, his own kind of most sort of prominent or most sort of central concern or central character trait. And so, but it's very illuminating. No pun intended, but each one sort of describes their own character, and they're quite kind of they're quite easy about it. So they're all arahants, except for Ananda. They're all totally enlightened. So they're not boasting. They're not being proud. They're not saying, "You know, my one's better than yours." But they just naturally talk about what they focused on and their own particular interests. So Venerable Revata talks about resolution. Energy and application of effort. Mahakasapa talks about asceticism. Mahamoggallana talks about psychic powers. And so and they're not critical of each other, and they're not boasting. They're saying, "Well, this is what I put attention and energy into, and this is sort of what's my how things take shape for me." So it's it's representing that kind of knowing yourself, atanyuta, and then being completely comfortable in that. So to continue, do you have a question, or is that just the approval? Okay. So to continue.
I thought it was 7 o'clock.
Not yet. No, 10:02. So the next one is Matanyuta, M-A-T-T-A, Matanyuta. This means knowing the right amount to cultivate a sense of moderation. If we know, quote, the right amount, unquote, in such areas as spending money, eating food, holidaying, and the consumption of global resources, we can live in a very well-balanced way. We can look after the needs of our own life and those we are responsible for without overtaxing resources or harming ourselves or others through the choices we make. To know moderation in speech, work and action, in rest and in the pastimes we adopt, it helps if we do all things with an eye on what is the point of it, what genuine benefits might result. The spirit of moderation guides us to act not merely for our own gratification or to accomplish our own ends, but rather to take into account the needs and preferences of all. But again, it's coming from an attunement to the way nature works and to what you need in terms of rest or the food or personal space. It's to do with your capacity, not coming from an idealistic place like, you know, I can pick this up, I can do this, you know, from a place of over-enthusiasm or idealism, but knowing the right amount is, I can pick up a, a 50-pound rock that I can't pick up a 100-pound rock. It's like that's. This is also knowing the right amount, knowing your own capacity, your own limits, and what you can do, what you can't do. So this is very helpful if you happen to be idealistic, to sort of to work with recognizing your own capacity, your own limits. Also, if you tend to overeat, or if you tend to undereat, knowing the right amount is if you tend to be starving yourself or not eating enough, then Matanyutara is like listening to the needs of the body and recognizing, well, I'm following my food limitation program, but I'm dizzy and I'm weak and I'm keeling over at 5 in the afternoon. Maybe I need to eat some more. And I'm not doing myself any good. Or if you're overeating, and then you find yourself stuffed and with indigestion, and you're not waking up from your nap until 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And you realize, I think I've been overdoing it there a bit. And, so that knowing the right amount is with food, with sleep, and so on, is again, it's based on this quality of mindfulness and full awareness. And one interesting piece of advice that the Buddha gives in relationship to food and the right amount of food, quote-unquote right amount, is, I'm not sure exactly where you find it in the scriptures, but it was a piece of advice that Ajahn Chah often repeated, which was to eat the right amount of food, pay attention to how you feel as you're eating, and when 5 more mouthfuls would be enough, then stop. And then finish off with water. Just fill yourself up with the last little bit with a glass of a cup of water, and then that'll be quote unquote the right amount. So it is interesting if you genuinely pay attention. You're not caught up with the act of eating, but you're paying attention to how the body feels, if you're attuning to that, then as you're eating, then there does come. There does come a moment where there is a clear sense of, oh, okay, that's enough, and something changes. And if you're really paying attention, the food that was in your bowl or on your plate goes from being sort of attractive and interesting, and then that point is reached, and it's like, okay, and then in a way it stops being food. It kind of, I mean, it doesn't magically transform into something else, but it's. It's suddenly that the there's that recognition. Okay, that's enough, and then the mind easily leaves the rest alone. It sort of stops being something that you're looking at or you're intending to eat. But the intuitive sense or the mind's relationship to what's there on the plate or in the bowl, it shifts. And okay, that's enough, and then. I fully acknowledge it's a challenge to put the spoon down at that point. but not to say, well, just in case, I might be deluded in that feeling. And this is very, very special. And after all, we put so much effort into it in the kitchen. I really want them to be able to make merit because of this wonderful food. And so I wouldn't want to rob people of their merit. I've heard all these trains of thought going through my mind in the past. But if we do genuinely bring mindfulness and full awareness to that, then there is quite a distinct point. And then just finish off with water and you're good to go. The next one is kalanyuta. Kala is time. So knowing the right time. This means knowing the time and place and situation. Knowing what the occasion is. If we consider carefully where we are and what's going on and the proper time to speak up or be quiet with respect to our actions, duties and engagements with other people, then we will regularly be a force for harmony and benefit. Kalanyuta encourages a sensitivity to when to arrive and depart, when to begin or end a conversation. It also means developing punctuality. It's a particular focus of mine, I've noticed. Speaking of character traits, punctuality, regularity, being in good time to meet responsibilities, staying with family or friends for the right amount of time and at the right time. As Benjamin Franklin, a famous late American politician from the 18th century, as Benjamin Franklin once noted, fish and visitors stink after 3 days. It probably sounds a bit rude, but I think it's also, having observed human nature, fish and visitors stink after 3 days. Kalanuta includes knowing how to plan our time and organize it effectively. So that, again, that's quality of attunement, and when so at the right time to show up for things, or the right time to bring things to an end in a conversation or in a meeting, or when things are done. So that quality of attunement and say paying attention to the flow of events, and check if you are arranging to stay with family or friends, just checking in advance how long they really want you to stay. 3 days is often a good amount of time, a day to arrive, then 2 or 3 days to be there, and then a day to depart. So. Any questions on that?
Ajahn?
Yes?
I would like to ask if could you explain the difference between the mind and the consciousness? Because once you've been saying, like, be confident in your own skin, sometimes it seems to me that all this manifestation, which I perceive as a construction, arise just from these skandhas. Like, whatever the chemistry is there, whatever combination of the elements. Actually, yesterday it was great as you mentioned that when I point a question, you said that sometimes just arise because of the chemistry and we don't have to identify.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we want confidence? Because what I work actually, I always work with some picture of myself, which is so rarely, I mean, it's so rare that it's just this outfit, the outer lion. It's just this, actually I don't work much with the inner, but the picture which arises in this mental state is just the outer layer, just the image
mm-hmm.
of myself. What a delusion is it?
Well, if I'm understanding what you're asking about, so but to use a phrase like being comfortable in your own skin, it's recognizing, well, this is all a mask. It is an outer layer. But this is the way that nature is formed, so that the all dhammas are not self, but the dhammas function in relationship to each other according to nature and the laws of cause and effect. And so that the particular personality or your language or your conditioning, it's not absolutely who and what you are, but that particular set of conditions is that the means or the format for this life to be happening. So that's the outer layer, if you like, the mask or the form, and so that using a phrase like being comfortable in your own skin, it's like that the heart is quite happy to be functioning through that particular set of conditions, being this particular age or this particular personality or being in this particular role, and so that it doesn't create a lot of suffering about or stress about, I want to be seen this way, I don't want to be seen that way, I want this set of conditions, I don't want that set of conditions, I want to feel this, I don't want to feel that, but rather, oh, here it is, this is, in this moment it's like this, oh, I'm fallen ill, okay, I'll work through illness, okay, I've recovered, I'll work through that. And then there's a sense of ease to working with through the medium of this particular life as it takes shape So it's known that it's just a form or a yeah. or a performance through the form. Per means through, form. Performance is through that form. So the mind is operating through that form. I mean, I just realized that's saying it now, actually. But it's through that form. So it's like an actor performing a particular role. You might be you show up in, if you're in a theatre company, you know, one week you're Desdemona, you know, next week you're Cleopatra, you know, or you're King Lear, you know, or, yeah, or the Duke of Orleans, you know. Here's your script. Okay, go. You know. And so that sense of being ready to function through the conditions of this life as it takes shape, it's coming from an attunement to nature and a respect for nature, how this body is, its limitations, its character. You're not, there isn't the sense of, I wish it was different, or that I want to be seen like this, I don't want to be seen like that. But rather, oh, it's like this, it's this way. And so there's an ease of functioning through that particular medium, rather like whether the weather is sunny and bright or the weather is cold and wet. You know, you're ready to work with the weather, whatever the weather is like. So that sense of being at home with your own body, your own personality, your own life story, that's a sense of being comfortable with working with this condition as it is, and to be ready to then learn lessons from the different aspects of it as those different events take shape and different qualities appear at different times. So that all dhammas are not self. It's not absolutely who and what we are. So that I can say, you know, on an absolute level, I'm not a human being. I'm not a monk. I'm not a man. These maleness, monkness, humanness, Englishness, Belgianness, they are particular patterns of conditioning and experience that have a relative truth, and they function in relationship to each other according to the laws of nature, laws of cause and effect. And so that we have our names. I don't suddenly come up with a new name. Well, I've got a few new names, actually. But generally, I'm known as Ajahn Amaro. If I suddenly told everyone, okay, you should now call me Stuart, or you should call me Lucy, you know, then it's like, well, oh, what name has it got today? Then it's confusing for everyone. So that then we use a name, we stick with that as a conventional form. But there isn't actually any absolute Amaro there. It's just a convention is used for convenience. So if the mind holds things in that way, then it's not taking... It's not attaching to existence or saying that this thing, these conventions are absolutely real, but it's not dismissing them or saying that there's no laws of cause and effect, or there's no way that our actions or our words have any value or meaning. They do. They, and that's why there's the wholesome and the unwholesome, the skillful and the unskillful. So what you have in the Buddha's teaching, and he spells this out in a number of places, he says, yeah, the middle way, say, everything exists as one extreme, nothing exists as the other extreme. The Tathagata teaches the Dhamma by the middle way. And then he explains dependent origination. He says, with ignorance as condition, formations come to be, with formations as condition, consciousness comes to be, and so on. So that middle way is recognizing that Sabbe sankhara, you know, all sankharas are impermanent, all dhammas are not self, but those sankharas, those aspects of nature, they function in relationship to each other by very distinct laws. The laws of cause and effect function. And so that's how there's goodness and badness, there's wholesome and unwholesome, there's skillful and unskillful. And so that being at home in our own skin, or being comfortable with, or at ease with this particular set of conditions, then it's part of, well, in this moment, the laws of nature are functioning like this and operating through this life in this way. And it's a sense of openness and acceptance to how things are functioning, so that whether there's health or sickness, you're okay. Whether there's praise or criticism, you're okay. Whether there's gain or loss, you're okay. Your peace or your happiness, your sense of freedom, doesn't depend on a particular set of conditions, or being seen in a particular way, or achieving certain results from the things that we do. So it's a kind, that's independence. That's a genuine kind of independence. You're through that quality of accepting the way that the world functions, but not grasping or not taking refuge in the world. So knowing the world, the heart attunes to the world, but it's not identified or limited by the world.
And I have one more question, Ajahn.
So does that answer the first question you had?
Yeah, you gave it. Yeah, but still, it seems to me like whatever I perceive is just offered by the senses, just like a bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And it's here, and then when I, for example, because of my imagination, when I look at the air, all these elements arise and passing away, yeah? But actually, of course, I do perceive everything as I, because I am very much deluded. And how is it possible that all of us, we do experience like differentiation? Of course, I do experience it, but how is this possible that there is no this interconnection?
Because of birth. Avijja Paccaya Sankhara. If we were totally enlightened, we wouldn't have been born. It's because we weren't totally enlightened that we got born. So then difference, separateness, and the kind of obviousness of separateness and individual existence is an effect of having been born, and the attachment to seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking that comes from birth. That's the seeming of things, the appearance of things. If we were totally enlightened, we wouldn't have been born. So we come into this from a place of not seeing things clearly. So then what is seen, heard, smelt, tasted, touched and thought, it seems to be absolutely real. And then we seem to be totally independent, separate beings. That's the seeming. But the practice of Dhamma and the spiritual path, as it's laid out, particularly by the Buddha in the Buddha's teaching, is that recognizing that this set of impressions, this seeming, is only the world of appearances, that it really looks that way. But you take a simple principle like, you know, all dhammas are not self. It's a way of looking at all of that, the feelings of I and me and mine that come up during the course of a day, and it's like drilling into that over and over again and think, well, I say I'm talking, or I'm seeing, I'm hearing. What's the I that's doing the seeing? What does that look like? The I that chooses these words. Is that a person? Is that a monk? Is that a male? Is that a, does it have a shape or a color, or where is it? And then as we use the powers of investigation, exploring, then those bubbles of self-creation get burst. And then slowly but surely, that the way that things seem, like the assumptions that we make, like everyone thinks like me as a sort of middle-class English person, no, it's not the case. It's just a set of conditioning. That's not an absolute reality. It's just like a pattern of perception, and that it was an appearance. It was a seeming. There was no permanent, separate, independent I there.
From analytical way, it's understandable, yeah? But to truly feel it or experience it,
that's why we practice. I think that's why we're all here. Yeah? So, that's why we practice, is because there's a a group of human beings gathered together in this little place in Hertfordshire and spend our days looking at our minds, because there's a recognition of, I don't think this is totally real. There's something beyond this. There's something that's more significant or more fundamental. And I'm pretty sure that's true, and all these other people around me, they also seem to think that's the case. So if we all work on this together, we support each other in this. Then as the practice develops, and there's more and more that of those moments of like, oh, this is the reality that underlies that set of perceptions in moments of self-relinquishment, seeing the empty nature of the appearances of independent existence. So that's why we practice. And then the result of that is those qualities of peacefulness and simplicity and liberation. I think that's a good point to end on for today. Good enough.
Tandamayandam uvavikataya sadhu karandadamase.
Sadhu.